into the gaming discourse. I am Tyler Frater alongside Richard Day the Cruz.
Hello.
And Chief Engineer Lieutenant Commander Connor Frater.
Good evening.
It is Monday, April 15th, 2024. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at The Gaming Discourse. Go to our YouTube channel, YouTube.com/Gaming Discourse, Patreon.com/The Gaming Discourse. You can support us for $247, $10. Get your name in the video credits, early access to our videos, access to our Discord server, more stuff like that. Richard, you just awkwardly, my entire flawless.
I'm sorry, it was very good. It was very good.
That I've whittled down to perfection over the years, but hey, whatever.
I saw this, the camera cap, and I was like, mentally, like, oh yeah, I'm gonna play with that. And I'm like, man, I hope I don't fucking drop it. And within a couple seconds, yeah.
Richard, Gaming Discourse FM, name pending. Do we have a new episode this week?
Yes, new episode will be this week. I was on vacation last week.
We'll have a new episode this week. Connor.
Yes.
Unrelated to anything video games mostly, but...
Lore Barge Journal.
Yeah, that's on Substack, correct?
LoreBargeJournal.substack.com. Yep.
Yeah.
Next post is going to be about dryads.
That sounds incredibly engaging. I can't wait. I wish I played D&D more often, but I don't because I don't have time or friends. So anyway,
it's a tough world out there,
which is why I force you to come here and talk video games.
No, I come here on my own free will. Yeah, we're talking about video games tonight. Let's go.
Okay, so you've been gone for the past couple weeks.
Yeah.
But you said there was a game you wanted to talk about, but you weren't sure.
Yeah, I'm not sure only because it's a JRPG and I've played about maybe 5 hours of it. But it's a remake of an old game called Star Ocean, the Second Story. And this one is Star Ocean, Second Story R, which I assume the R means remake. But it came to my store and it is something I wanted to play because it takes the same approach that the Octopath Traveler series does. It has this 2D HD type visual presentation. And as I play it... As soon as I started moving around, I got slightly emotional because it kind of felt, looks and feels very much like the older PS1 games, just in general PS1 games. We have that same type of, you did not play the original Resident Evil 4. You've only played the VR version, right?
Yeah, no, I don't. I've seen gameplay and stuff like that, but I've never played the VR version, yeah.
There are games that you can play. So this is when we talk about remaking games, there's a lot of games that need to be remade because there are some games from 25, 30 years ago that cannot play as good as games do today. However, there are some games from the PS1 era or PS2 era that if you were to play their remake, it feels exactly the same. Mm. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And so in this instance, it feels like I'm playing an old PS2 JRPG. And I think that the game so far, what it's presented to me is very astonishing from a visual standpoint, because the character models are sprite-based characters. But they feel just a little more defined and a little more... HD, not as HD as Octopath Traveler is, because Octopath Traveler uses when you fight enemies, the enemies are 3-4 times the size of your character. Mm-hmm. But with Star Ocean, your characters are all the same size comparatively to each other. You just have more detail to them. And so you see characters who have very funny, when they get hit, they have that very funny, like their mouth goes really big and their eyes go really big and stuff like that. The biggest comparison, I'm going to keep comparing it to Octopath Traveler because they have similar styles. Octopath has this storybook look to it where all the buildings, all the characters, everything looks like a pop-up book. And it's very, very visually appealing. Star Ocean... everything is HD... The grass is not pop-up book style. It is 3D grass.
Okay, interesting.
But it's very, very defined. The buildings look as if they were pre-rendered buildings, but they just made 3D models of those pre-rendered buildings.
Oh, okay.
So despite them being somewhat not very detailed and like low poly, they look very good.
Interesting. Okay.
And the way that they both kind of clash with each other really make it so visually appealing. But the game is so far very interesting, and I like the story because you have the choice of choosing between a male character and the female character, and they both have their own stories that intercross with each other. And I chose Reyna, who's the female character, and she's on a little village on a planet, and she goes into a sacred forest consistently because that's her like safe space, and she ends up finding the male character who saves her from a monster. The male character is from space. He's from Earth, mm-hmm. but she's like, I don't know what Earth is. So we're in the far future in this game. But she's in a village that's very like, you know, old timey. She has elf ears and whatnot, but he has modern day clothing. And so she believes him to be the hero of light that's come to save their town. And he has secrets because he's seemingly like, yeah, I'm from space, but I can't exactly tell you I'm from space, and I can't exactly tell you where I'm from. So there's a calamity that happened on their planet, and so he's kind of being roped into that, and so is she because she has her own history. But the game is not turn-based. It's action-based somewhat. You have punches and kicks and maneuvers, but they do cost time. So if I were to use an ability called Crush, and she like summons a rock from space, I have a little bar that I have to wait for it to fill up before it activates.
Yeah, okay.
So like I can press it to activate, but she has to like conjure it up. So you have to do it before like the enemies will like run to you and like hit you.
This sounds very similar to the game that was heavily influenced by
Sea of Stars.
Chrono Trigger.
Sea of Stars.
That just came out like last year. Was it Sea of Stars?
Yeah, Sea of Stars. Yeah.
That's the same thing where you had a brother and sister and you could pick. And in that one, you could like parry attacks if you hit X right at the right moment.
Yeah, you can do that like here as well. Yeah, before an enemy hits you, you can press B and like kind of dodge it. But
I figured that stuff was probably, there's like a history of that stuff in those sort of RPGs going back. It wasn't like Sea of Stars wasn't the first game to do those sorts of
things. Yeah, no, it wasn't the first, because like the other one that came out a couple years ago, Indivisible, was a kickstarted game. That one takes a lot of cues from a game called Valkyrie Profile, which was also kind of action based. But I've gotten as far as to where the first portion in the village is complete, and now we're on the journey. So I'm greatly, greatly enjoying it. I do have, right before I left for the week, I got Dragon's Dogma 2.
Oh, man.
I haven't been able to, I let somebody else borrow it because I was like, I'm going to be.
I've heard people really dislike it. I've heard people that love it, can't get enough of it.
I forgot who was, I can't remember if it was Cat Bailey or someone else, but they were like, oh, it's one of the weird, like, someone will tell you, like, it's full of jank. There's lots of really weird things about it. This game is really awkward and weird. It's my favorite game of all time. You know, so it's just like, okay, like, and that's what I hear. So, so I would like to try it out, but yeah. And yeah, that's it. That's the big thing I've been playing recently.
Connor,
just continuing with, Red Dead mostly.
Okay.
I've talked about it for hours on this podcast, so I don't think I need to add much more.
What number playthrough is this?
I think five.
Five? Very nice. I've said this before. Red Dead Redemption is one of the games that I haven't stopped thinking about since I finished it for the first time. Now I'd like to go back to it one day, but I have to find 70 hours somewhere in a couple months where there isn't a bunch of games coming out, because go ahead.
Same. Oh, sorry. Same. Yeah. There's I'm sure Connor has seen him, but there's a gentleman, older gentleman, who's streamed himself playing Red Dead 2 the entire time. And he's popped up on my feed, and I've watched him complete this game. And, every time I'm like, I need to go back to Red Dead 2 'cause I played it. Mm-hmm. Obviously wonderful game. Excellent. But I feel like I didn't get it. I didn't get it the first time. And so, yeah, I re-downloaded it, and I'm like, I got it. But once again, that mm-hmm. time, you know, and then I wanted to try to do more than I did the first time around because I felt like I rushed it the first time around. And
one of my favorite little nuggets of history in Red Dead 2. So there was, what was his name? He was a French writer. Alex started with a D, like DeCampo, Alex. I don't remember now. But anyway, he's a French writer who wrote this really famous book about his impressions of America when he like went on a big excursion in the United States.
Okay.
Right around the late 1700s or something like that. And he wrote this big profile about the United States and the U.S. and American culture and all that stuff. But I think it was him. But he wrote this sentence about, maybe it was after the Civil War. It was between 1790s and the 1890s, somewhere in that 100-year span.
Just in that century.
Book. Yeah. He wrote this book and he talked about the man. I think it was old Southern mansions, right? And how he described them, how they were like ghosts of a time that had come and gone. And in Red Dead Redemption 2, you stay in an old dilapidated mansion mm-hmm. that used to be like a plantation mansion. And it's eerie because right down the street are like... is the front line of a battle. And there's still cannons and stuff left over. And that stuff always just it's always rattling around my head because it's like such an evocative like a set piece for a game. But anyway, so I've been doing a lot. The Fallout TV series is not a game, but it's based on a game, and I think it's very good so far. So I'll talk about it a little bit. I won't spoil anything. Walton Goggins is just he plays the ghoul. He's just so good in it. It's one of those characters where every scene he's in, he's doing something cool and he steals so much of the show, and it's really fun to watch him. And it seems like it's a role that he is having a lot of fun with. Like, I get to be a cowboy who's this monster.
Yeah.
And so in some of the shots and some of the lines that he has, it just seems like he was just having the time of his life. The show feels very much like a Fallout game. It's like almost like you're watching gameplay footage at times. Because it has a really dark sense of humor. There's all kinds of ridiculous zany stuff that goes on. Rad roaches are kind of like a joke. Like there's a scene where a rad roach is like crawling up a window, and it's just an establishing shot that doesn't matter. And the rad roach like just falls off the window for no reason. So it has sort of a slapsticky humor about rad roaches. If you're into Fallout, I recommend it. I know that there's been discussions about like lore and stuff, and I don't know. I think Fallout is a series that is probably safer to set a game in because it's not about a specific character. It's about a world, so you can do a lot of stuff with that. You can take that in directions as opposed to something like Halo, where you have the Master Chief, where there is so much established mm-hmm. about who this character is. Yeah. So when you have him with his helmet off all the time, it sort of puts off fans of the game because that's not that's not the Master Chief, which is weird. But like so far, it's made me want to go back and play. I installed New Vegas just to hop in and be like, oh yeah, like a nice sip of a cup of coffee I haven't had in a while or something like that. But yeah, I would recommend it. I won't say much more because Connor, you haven't watched it, have you?
No, but I was gonna say real quick, just to touch on the whole lore issues. The games have inconsistent lore.
Yeah.
The show being inconsistent, it's consistent with the inconsistency, so it's fine.
Yeah, I just wanted to put a disclaimer there because I am empathetic towards people who don't like it when, like, you know, with Star Trek, it's similar. Mm-hmm. When we have something that's established and then a new thing gets made and it doesn't seem to care about any of the stuff that was established beforehand, I'm empathetic to that. At the same time, I think there are instances where it doesn't matter as much, where you can skip over it to make something cool and new. But it feels like the Fallout show, it feels like the Fallout show is made by people who have played the game, because there's so many like little jokes and offhand weird things that I don't know, if you didn't play the games, you may think we're funny, but when you play the game, you sort of get the yeah. deeper meta joke yeah. there, you know? So, yeah, and there's entire scenes where it feels like it's a dungeon dive in Fallout, where the characters go into a building and they go through all this stuff in the building, and it's like, this is literally a scene, this is literally a piece of the game. There's a scene where a character goes into the building, meets a Codsworth, I forget what that thing's called.
Yeah, Codsworth.
And then ends up like having the Codsworth help them, and it's like, okay, that's totally use your hack skill, yeah, yeah. get the Codsworth to help you out. It's like, it's literally like a piece of the game. Anyway, so yeah, highly recommend.
So real quick, the Mr. Handy robot that you're talking about, mm-hmm. voiced by Matt Berry.
Yes.
Oh shit, is it? God
damn it. Yes. And it's amazing. Yeah, cuz it's just all it was, I'm sure when they were shooting the scene, it was just Matt Berry in a mocap suit. And he was like, "Well, how that?" Like, you know, with all, it's like Tim Heidecker with all those like white balls on him, you know, just walking around. No, yeah, it's it's just Matt Berry playing Matt Berry. He has awesome. No affectation. It's just him, and it's great.
It's 90% of his characters, which is always delightful.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so I've been playing more Rise of the Ronin. The more I play Rise of the Ronin, the more I really enjoy it. I was having trouble with the parrying in combat, because it's kind of weird because weapons parry different ways. But once I nailed down how to parry, and once I picked the weapons that I really liked and figured out how to use, I really started to enjoy the combat more. And I even kicked the difficulty up to the hardest difficulty setting, and I think it's really good on the hardest difficulty setting. One thing I like when games do with difficulty settings is, instead of just making the game harder, it makes things more important. So I think Witcher did this, the Metro games did this, and so like in Rise of the Ronin, when you up the difficulty setting, applying fire or poison to your sword really helps.
Oh,
because if you're yeah. fighting a powerful enemy and you poison them, you can just avoid them and let the poison eat away at their health. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you have that poison on your blade and you're playing on normal, you'll probably kill them just with the blade. You don't have to worry about so much about applying poison. Stuff like that. There's different things you can eat that upgrade your... that make you, like, give you damage resistance or help you deal more damage. And those... come much more in handy on the higher difficulty settings. So I would say, as I played it more and as I like figured out the things that I wanted to do, I got better and better. And when I started playing it, I was like, okay, this is fun. Now it's like, this is probably going to be one of my favorite games this year. Like, this will probably be something that I may consider game of the year worthy. I don't know. And the other game that finally released that I am so excited to talk about is Pacific Drive.
The physical version.
Pacific Drive came out, yeah, a couple months ago, and it was going to have a physical version, and I like to get physical copies of my games, and so I was like, okay, I will wait and I'll pre-order the physical edition, just like $10 extra, and it comes with some other fun stuff. And I was like, and I'll play it, because I was looking forward to it for a long time. I played the demo. When I played the demo, I was like, okay, I'm sold. Pacific Drive thus far is very good. Unfortunately, I don't know if I would recommend it on PS5. It's locked at 30 FPS at 4K, which on the PC, it doesn't have anything like that. That I get used to it after a while, but man, it is jarring to go from 30 FPS to Rise of the Ronin, which is like almost a smooth... Rise of the Ronin has a variable refresh rate, but it's like super smooth, so that like to go back and forth, it's like, oh god. So I don't know if I'd recommend it for PS5, just because of the how it's running. It runs consistently, it runs fine. It's not like crashing or anything. It's just if you're playing a bunch of other games on the PS5 that are running at higher frame rates, it's kind of a jolt to get to get a frame rate that is, I would say sometimes even drops to like the low 20s in some spurts, but doesn't stop the game from being really good. Pacific Drive is a driving survival game. You have a station wagon. You have to drive out into a zone, an area called, I forget exactly what it's called, but it's the concept of a zone, right? So you think Stalker, which is based on the book, or the movie Stalker, which is based on the book Roadside Picnic. And then the movie Stalker influenced the game Stalker. And then you have like games like Into the Radius, which is heavily influenced by that. So in this zone, there's all kinds of weird anomalies and all kinds of strange, like not monsters, but entities, I guess, partly mechanical. It's really weird.
Okay.
And you kind of just have to drive around and maintain your car. There is a story. You meet a couple of the characters. You don't meet them. You meet them via radio, but they are people living in the zone, studying it, and they kind of want you to help them out and figure out what's going on. But basically, it's a car management simulator with like, but instead of you taking the car out to race, you take it out to survive in the zone. So your car, you have to refuel it. You have to replace parts on it. So like the hood, the side panels, the doors, the engine, the tires, the bumpers can all get broken in different ways, can all get destroyed. So you can build new ones and replace them. There's stuff that you can use to repair all that. So like if one of your doors gets broken to the point where it's falling off or something like that, you can bring repair putty with you and you slap some repair putty on and it repairs the door and you're fine. Your car protects you from radiation hazards and stuff while you're inside of it. So if you lose a part, you lose some of that protection while you're inside of it. So you kind of want to keep your car intact. It is a very mean game because it doesn't explain what all you kind of have to discover a lot of the anomalies. So like one anomaly that you'll encounter pretty quickly is a giant hurricane-like storm. And it doesn't tell you that it's on its way. You just look at, I just noticed it on the map one day. There was this yellow blob floating toward me. And I was like, well, what's that? And it started to get really, really windy. And before I knew it, my car was being blown through the wilderness. And I was like running into trees. And I was trying to like steer my car into the wind. And I was beat to hell. So it's like you'll be collecting resources or doing a thing here and there, and you'll see on your map, oh, here comes the storm.
Okay.
So it's like you find a safe place to park. Oh, your car has to, you start your car, you have to start the engine, you put it into park and drive. You don't, there's not a, it's an automatic gear shift, I guess. I don't know if there's an option to actually have gear shifts, but you put it into park and drive. And you're basically driving around, collecting stuff. It's, in some ways, it's a pretty standard, like, management sim, resource collecting. You get resources, you build a gear, and then you need two gears to build a door, and you need like plastic and other resources to build that door. So like in a lot of survival games, you have to get resources that make higher tier resources to make a big thing, and that's similar in Pacific Drive. And yeah, I'm really enjoying it. In one of the big first missions you go on, both of my headlights were out and it was night, so I was just driving in the darkness like trying to figure out where I was going or what I was supposed to do. And to fix my headlights, it told me what I needed to fix, or I told me what I needed to have to fix my headlights, but I wasn't a high enough level. I hadn't unlocked it yet. So I was just driving around in the dark, like trying not to crash my car into everything. Cause if you smack your car into trees or walls or whatever, it'll damage it. So that was not fun. So like now I make sure that I always have lights because when you don't have lights at night, it becomes very, very difficult. But yeah. Oh, and then the other thing is there is a certain roguelike element to it. So the zone, the concept, the danger with the zone is that reality is unstable. So every time you drive to a place, the roads and the buildings appear in different shapes and locations. Okay. I don't know if it's technically procedurally generated or if they just have a bunch of templates. I don't know. But anyway, things always change. So You go to like a, how it works is on your map, you have little zones, and to drive to a zone, you pick it, your guy drives there, and then you arrive in the zone. It's this big open map. On your map, you'll see buildings that you can go to. You'll maybe see gas stations, whatever. And you have a few minutes, but after a few minutes, an instability storm comes. And the instability storm is kind of like the circle in PUBG. Yeah. Like, it sort of closes in on the map. There's the first one that's like a warning. And then there's the second red one that comes in slower. And basically, if you're caught in that storm, your car starts to get demolished heavily. So you have to either drive to the next zone or exit the zone before that storm catches up with you. So it has a little roguelike elements there, because you may have a bunch of buildings or a bunch of resources you want to get, but you're up against the clock in some areas. So you kind of have to hurry up and get through it or get out of it before the storm catches up with you. I think, yeah, I'm really enjoying it. I think it's another game that's probably going to be one of my favorite games this year. Yeah, and then when you're back in the garage and you're repairing your car, it's actually kind of meditative and fun. You can repair specific panels on your car, as I said. So, like, with the lowest tier is, what's the lowest tier? It's like makeshift door. And then after that is steel door. And the steel door is better. So you can sort of one at a time. I replaced all the panels and doors on my car as I got enough resources. So now it's like my car has gone from makeshift to all steel. So now it's like, okay, now I have a better protection of my car. And so for
that right allows now, you to stay out longer, I assume, right?
Yeah. Or it can take more damage. So okay. If I run into a tree, it doesn't blow up instantly or something like that. But yeah, so I recommend it. There are some things that I think are divisive about the game. The game is very dark, like I said. So if your headlights get smashed or something, it can be difficult. There's also there's no flashlight available yet for me. I've been playing for a while. You have to use flares, but flares go out. So when you go into a building, it's almost pitch black in these buildings. Now, resources have outlines. So like there'll be a backpack and you'll see the outline of a backpack. And you're like, okay, run up to that, open it, take whatever's inside. But everything is nearly pitch black. So if you want light, you have to use flares, but flares go out. So it's like early on, you're carrying 10 flares with you because every building you go into, you kick in the door, light the flare, you grab as much stuff as you can so you can get out and have that flare lit so you can go into the next building and have light. I unlocked a relightable flare, a flare that I can light and then like turn the light off and turn it back on somehow. I don't remember how. But anyway, so that kind of works as a flashlight, but again, it after a while it breaks and you have to build a new one. So there isn't like a, I think some people may not like that there isn't just like a flashlight you can use.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not a fan of repairing things constantly, things constantly breaking, games being mean to you and throwing you into purposefully like setting up traps for you and stuff like that to get into, you may not like it. But I think it's a lot of fun. And it is one of those games where you have to discover stuff. The threats, you don't know what they do. You don't know what they are. So you kind of find it, you scan it, you read a little bit about it, and then you kind of have to know how to react to it. Like I said, with that storm, I didn't know really what was happening. And before I knew it, my car was being thrown through the wilderness. And I'm like, oh God, I'm like trying to, it really was like me trying to steer a ship into a storm, you know, and I'm just getting battered and beaten on every side. And, but when you survive that and you exit and you bring all those resources back and you fix up your car, it's like, hell yeah, I survived.
Yeah.
So yeah, highly recommend it if that sounds like something you'd be interested in. Okay, is there anything else we would like to discuss before we...
You highly recommend it, not on PlayStation 5, if you don't like the switching between frame rate.
Yeah, because like it can be jarring if you're playing multiple games. Have something run at a smooth 60 and then go to something running in 30 FPS, it's like, oh, Jesus, I get used to it and it's fine. But just that first like 5 minutes, it's a little difficult to put up with. But yeah, okay, we'll hit the ad. Thanks for listening. If you like our content, please consider subscribing or leaving a like and comment. You can find us at patreon.com/thegamingdiscourse. And our tiers are $2, $4, $7, and $10 and include getting your name in the video credits, early access, and access to our Discord server. Okay, so we're going to talk about this possibility space story. This possibility space story has a lot of lore, has a lot of details. We're going to split it up into two parts. I'm going to separate them and try to reduce it down to the most important points, but there's a lot of stuff, and I'm afraid that a lot of this is going to be made moot soon because it's all in reaction to an upcoming story, an upcoming Kotaku article apparently. But anyway, so okay, in late March, Crop Circle Games closed. Crop Circle Games was founded by Annie DeLisi Strain and Jeff Strain in 2022. Jeff Strain was also one of the co-founders of Undead Labs, who made State of Decay. And this is connected to possibility. This is connected to possibility space, I promise. Okay, so Crop Circle Games closed in late March. At the time, a statement from Crop Circle attributed the studio closure to changing player tastes and market conditions, saying the studio's current project was not commercially viable. After the closure, one former employee said on LinkedIn that the entire staff was let go without severance. Another said they had to sign away their right to compensation from any NLRB/DIIR action in exchange for 2 months of healthcare. Then, in early April, Annie DeLisi Strain posted another update about Crop Circle's closure, saying, among other things, that she learned Kotaku's Ethan Gatch was writing an article about the closure, and I'm going to read what she says. Quote, I got a text this afternoon that Ethan Gatch of Kotaku is writing an article about the closure of Crop Circle Games. Mr. Gatch has not contacted me about his article, nor confirmed details in his article with me. I stepped down as CEO this winter on a medical leave. While I don't know the content of Mr. Gotch's article, I have no assurances that my personal health struggles as a rare female game industry CEO will not be covered in his article. The thought of a random man I have never met talking about my personal health, my body, in a public forum without my consent is so ghastly to me that I'm now choosing to share before he does that I have multiple sclerosis. If you're unaware of what multiple sclerosis is, it is a very serious disease. Connor and I have a family member that has it. It can be hugely debilitating. It's a disease that there's not a lot of expertise or knowledge on, as far as I know. And our family member has to go to another state to like a specific doctor to get information on it, or to get treatments for it and stuff like that. So it's a very serious medical condition. After detailing her experience with multiple sclerosis, Annie DeLisi Strain says this, quote, as for Mr. Gotch and his article for Kotaku, I have enormous compassion and sympathy for him. Kotaku is owned by Geo Media, which is in turn owned by a private equity firm in Boston. As other Geo brands are sold and their teams fired, Mr. Gotch must be under incredible pressure to generate clicks and satisfy advertisers. Watching the meltdown in games media has been just as awful and searing as experiencing the meltdown with development jobs, and I empathize with Mr. Gotch's situation, end quote. Okay, so that's part one, is Crop Circle Games shuts down. Ethan Gotch is writing an article about it. Employees are saying we were let go without severance. We had this other stuff going on. And then Annie DeLisi Strain says in her statement that she's worried about her personal healthcare being divulged in a story. So there's a lot of stuff going on. So we'll discuss this first.
Yeah.
What do we think about this? And then we'll get into the possibility space.
Where do I want to start here? Very strange that that Crop Circle Games would shut down in March, right? Or April?
No, March. I think it was late March when they officially shut down.
Yeah,
like 22nd or something.
But I don't know how game companies or industries operate, but it is very weird that instead of changing player taste and market conditions, I understand, but changing player taste, I don't understand how that affects your company to the point where you have to shut down rather than just refocus your time and effort to something else.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which I do find interesting, used as a, I'm not going to say excuse, but a reasoning for the closure of the studio. I am, I don't know what Miss Strain is going through, and it sucks to hear about that. But I don't know what type of we don't know what type of information until the article comes out that yeah. that Ethan from Kotaku has gotten. But even then, if she was so she is already so protective about her condition, how would Ethan get that information from the company? Does that make it make sense what I'm trying to say? So when you're CEO and you step down, you don't necessarily have to give a reason like to anybody.
Sure.
But you could say like I'm stepping down due to medical reasons and that's it. Like you don't have to give any more information. Or at least I assume you don't have to. But if she had stepped down and had told the entire company like I'm stepping down because of this reason, I don't know if you would consider that fair game when it comes to a journalist coming around and knocking on the door and being like, why are these sets of things happening? But he assumedly is only reporting about the closure of the studios, not necessarily her health in general. Mm-hmm. That could just be a footnote in the larger story, which either way, I understand wanting to have the permission of speaking about it, of somebody else's health in an article. But it's very strange to when somebody comes out kind of swinging before somebody else has their pieces of information. It seems like one side is worried about other information that may come out as well.
Yeah, well, so you want to be empathetic because
agreed.
Somebody put out sensitive information about their health on the internet.
Yes. So
it's like, okay. Mm-hmm. We'll start with the thing about the player taste change. I think that's bizarre. In what capacity to
right.
have player how, like what are people
what,
not
what has
playing?
Happened? Yeah, what has happened what, in the last
what
three
game
years?
Were they making like what kind of game were they making that nobody is playing today? I just don't understand. If you told me it's because the publisher wanted a live service game and mm-hmm. the game you were making didn't fit that. That sucks, but that makes more logical sense of why a studio mm-hmm. would shut down. But like to say that player tastes change, there are so many people playing video games. There are so many niches of people that play so many different kinds of video games. It's just strange to me that somehow you would find that there is so little a market for your game that the best thing to do is just close up shop.
Yes.
That's bizarre. Okay, so besides that, I think the question is like, yeah, and like I said, a lot of this is going to be moot once this story comes out. but it's news now, and it does pose some interesting questions. Like, okay, would an MS diagnosis be relevant to a story? And I don't think that's an open and shut thing. Like, right. Give me the context. If I'm an editor, it's like, tell me why it's relevant to the story, right? There are instances where somebody's name or somebody's something that happened to somebody is almost never relevant. Like one of the if you go to journalism school, one of the first things you learn is if you're writing a story about sexual assault and it's against a minor, you don't need to put out the name.
No,
because you're talking about a kid, you're talking about a serious issue. Mm-hmm. That kid doesn't need to be publicly named in a news story somewhere.
Right.
So that's like the extreme situation, right? But a case like this. It's a disease. It's not sexual assault. It's still to be taken seriously. But yeah, like it's not, I don't think it's impossible to imagine a scenario where, I don't want to make things up, but I don't think it's impossible to imagine a scenario where naming the disease or being more, or disclosing more details about what was going on within the company may be something that Ethan thinks is necessary to get the truth across, right? Like, I don't think it's totally crazy. It is strange that the statement is preempting something that may not even, because again, we don't even know if the diagnosis is even in the story.
Right.
It's just, it could be maybe, I don't know. Mm-hmm. So let me preempt by saying, How dare you?
Yes, you know,
which comes across a little weird.
Yes.
Now, who knows? Maybe in a month the story comes out, and I don't think Ethan Gotch has ever written anything that made me mad. But maybe I'll read that and go, I can't believe you wrote that. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. the statement will be 100% correct. I don't know. But it's hard. It's hard not to look into this and read almost like especially with the ending here, right? The I have enormous compassion and sympathy for Kotaku. Geo is owned by Geo Media, right? Under incredible pressure to generate clicks and satisfy advertisers. Okay, so the issue with that is long form journalism does not generate money. Mm-hmm. That's why you don't see it in a whole lot of places, and that's why Geo Media is forcing Kotaku to do guides and tips,
mm-hmm.
because guides and tips satisfy SEO requirements, right? So if anything, it's guides and tips that advertisers want to hear about.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the thing that generate clicks. So that's just incorrect. That's just false. You can call it clickbait all you want, but it's just incorrect. Unless you're writing a guide for a game that hasn't come out yet or something like that. I don't know. It's hard for me to believe that the only reason Ethan Gotch and Kotaku is writing on this, is working on this story, is because it'll generate clicks. Because even if it did, the amount of clicks you would get from SEO bullshit stories dwarf what you would get from like a gossip rag type thing, which is what she's trying to make it out to be, right? Like, oh, you're generating clicks by writing about me, as if it's some kind of gossip rag column, which again, it's incorrect, because advertisers don't want that anyway. They don't care about gossip rag stuff. What they want is stuff that fills up the Google search when somebody types in Rise of Ronin, how to get this armor, and then you get a bunch of stories and guides, and then people click on it and scroll, and that's when the ads pop up. So that's just incorrect. Okay, and considering that, it's hard not to read into the statement and feel like it's almost like a dog whistle.
Mm-hmm.
A games journalist at Kotaku is writing this about me. Like, I don't know. Maybe that's wrong of me to think, but that's how it came off.
Well, yeah, they're trying to belittle, like, the source before, you know, the story hits.
That's just how it came off to me. I don't know if that's unfair of me to say, but that's definitely how it felt, especially when we got to the end and how patronizing that was, that I understand their situation. Now, well, you clearly don't, because no advertiser anywhere gives a shit about long-form reporting. All they want is SEO bullcrap, and there's ample evidence of that. Just look at any content mill anywhere. Right? Watch Mojo isn't doing 6.5-hour documentaries about the Roman Empire. They're making top 10 anime portrayals or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's because it's quick and it fills up SEO searches. So it's like, you're just incorrect there. Anyway, okay, do we have anything else we want to say about this? Connor, sorry, I wasn't looking at the screen, so I don't know if you had... Your mic is muted, I think. We've lost Connor. Okay. Continue. I can see you. I cannot hear you.
Oh no.
We lost Connor. We are moving on. Okay. Part two. Hello? Oh, there you are. Hey. What happened?
Don't know.
Okay. Well, we have you back now.
I have nothing to say. Continue.
Okay. Well, I'm glad we went through all that.
Easy.
I'm glad we went through all that. That brilliant 15 seconds of audio where I was going, are you there? Are you there? Okay. Part two. Possibility Space shuts down. Okay. So now we're at what happened this past week. So again, Possibility Space was founded by Jeff Strain in 2021. Late last week, Possibility Space employees posted on social media that the studio had closed. Polygon's Nicole Carpenter obtained an email from Strain sent to staff about the closing. In the email, Strain blamed the closure on internal leaks from the studio to Kotaku's Ethan Gotch, who's currently working on the story about Prytania Media, which I think was the parent company to Crop Circle Games.
Okay, yeah.
But I think Prytania Media is also something that the Strains co-founded. I think it's all their venture. I think it's all
Alrighty.
One gigantic thing. So I'm going to read, this is a big chunk of the email, but I think a lot of it is important. So again, this email is what Jeff Strain sent to Possibility Space employees as they were shutting down. Quote, late last week, I received a list of topics and questions from Ethan Gotch, a reporter at Kotaku, regarding an article he's writing about Prytania Media and the closure of Crop Circle Games. Much of it was expected, but I was also stunned to see non-public information about Project Vonnegut, which is their in-development game. Disclosure of our publishing partner and details of our business and financial relationship and details of internal profit and loss discussions and confidential all-company meetings. Mr. Gotch specifically credits current employees as the source of his information. Leaks of this nature are typically malicious and done by outside hacking. So to see internal team members under a confidentiality agreement engage in this was shocking. Given the company's own strict confidentiality and non-fiction obligations, notification obligations, I immediately got on a plane for in-person meetings with our publishing partner to discuss the impact on the project. During that discussion, our partner expressed low confidence they would be willing to invest the additional resources needed to complete the game, so we mutually agreed to cancel Vonnegut. As a result of the cancellation of the publishing relationship, and after careful consideration, I am closing possibility space, end quote. Strain said he would be stepping away from the games industry to focus on his family and care for his wife. Okay, so again, disclaimer, we don't even know what the story is about. We don't know what's happening. Right. It just got a lot more difficult for Ethan Gotch. You're going to have to update a lot of that draft. But other than that, okay, this part now.
Yeah.
What do we think about this? Because this is almost a totally different animal now.
Yeah, it's totally different.
We're firing all of you. How dare you talk to the media?
Yeah, yeah. It's also a different excuse.
Right?
Than what, you know, we were given with the previous story. People in confidentiality agreements talk to press all the damn time.
Yes.
that's not a really big thing. But it is very strange because, yeah, as in your notes, you speak about it a little later. We've had leaks on GTA 6. We've had leaks on
Naughty Dog,
and probably one of the biggest leaks in the last like 10 years is the Insomniac leaks.
Oh yeah,
that just happened as well.
And that was actually a malicious.
Yes, yeah. All five of like their major games, the Ratchet and Clank, Spider, they're not canceling them.
Yeah,
they'll shift around some stuff possibly, but I can't imagine. If those leaks happening to the biggest studios in the world is not affecting them whatsoever, I can't imagine how some leaks of this nature, specifically with the game that hasn't seemed to be in development for very long, have such a negative outcome on not just the game, but the entire studio as well.
Uh-huh.
It's possible that Britannia Media maybe wanted to cut their losses just with whatever was going on with Crop Circle Games. Well,
it was the publishing partner with Britannia Media.
Right.
Right.
But they spoke with Crop Circle Games to like cut. Yeah.
Because we're talking about like 18 different studios here.
Yeah.
All owned by Jeff Strain. So
right.
It's very confusing. I would think is it really that big of a deal that you're going to shut down a studio over it? I don't know. I'm thinking if I'm the publishing partner, maybe I should, how do I put this delicately? Quit being a bitch. I don't know. like, are you investors? Wherever you're getting your capital from,
mm-hmm.
are you really so concerned with this story that it's best that you shut down an entire company and say, see ya, we're not publishing this game?
Mm-hmm.
Is it really that damning what's going to be? Because all kinds of stuff has come out about Ubisoft. Guys got... Sergei Hasko was arrested in France because of what went down with Ubisoft, right? Ubisoft's games are still being sold, and the company is going strong.
Yeah.
Even if Yves should be fired, company's fine. So it's like, it's weird to me that a publisher out there would overreact like this,
mm-hmm.
which is strange, which I think probably means we just don't know the full story yet.
Yeah,
because to me that just seems like a complete overreaction, throwing a baby out with the bathwater because a journalist is working on a story.
Right.
Unless what the journalist is going to report is embarrassing stuff that you don't want to be associated with, I don't want to speculate too much because we don't know, but like, if it's just boring financial crap, mm-hmm. then it's like, is that really such a big deal that you have to cut your relationship with somebody which results in tons of layoffs and stuff like that?
And it is, and I'm not, you know, I didn't take journalism for very long as much as you did, but it feels like if you have a response like this from people you're doing a story about, even before your story comes out, that gives even more reason to release this story. Like, is that like?
I would say yes. I would say it makes me curious. If that, yeah, maybe there's a little, because there's a whole lot of smoke, right?
Because these are very big jumps, you know, as far as like
closing entire studios. Yes. Yeah.
Not just closing the entire studios, but yeah, the two heads giving two completely different reasons as to why, you know,
sure.
their studio closed down or things are happening the way they are.
Yeah. And then the other thing is, you know, I would think is if, I don't know, if I'm leading a studio and a bunch of people, their jobs are, I hold their jobs in my hand, I would think I would go to bat for them, mm-hmm. even if I knew that they leaked things or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't know how many people worked. I don't know how many people worked at Possibility Space, but it's like you're going to punish the entire studio for the actions of how many of them? Do we know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. To me, it feels like if I'm responsible for a team of people in the games industry, I'm fighting tooth and nail to keep them in their jobs.
Yeah.
I'm not going to, you know, fly to a publisher who's got apparently their tails between their leg, all scared. Like, I'm going to fight for them. That just seems logical to me, right? You're not just going to cut your losses and get out of there. Now, again, Jeff talks about leaving the game space and helping his wife, which we could all empathize with. I get that, right? Like, I can't handle all this right now.
Yeah.
I've got a new diagnosis. But that is separate from laying off a ton of people at the beginning of the year when we have so much industry turnover. I don't know. I feel like if you have the responsibility of holding a bunch of people's jobs in your hands, then that's just the burden of leadership is you're going to have to protect those jobs. Or else, why did you begin the endeavor in the first place? The other thing I wanted to mention is I thought it was interesting that, because, Annie DeLisi Strain mentioned that Ethan Gotch had not reached out to her yet, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's interesting because that she's the CEO. And if you're working on a story, it's like, hey, why haven't you reached out to the CEO yet? If you're already writing the story. And I think that's an interesting question. And I think it's also the correct move. Because with people in positions of power, if something is going on that's it's wrong and you're going to approach them with an interview, you have to approach them with things that they have to be held to account with. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So that means you have to talk with the other employees. You have to tell me what happened, what's going on. And then you get all these questions. The game was canceled or, there was crunch. There was a toxic workplace. And then you take those to the CEO at the end, right? That way you have all these things that they have to answer for. If you go to the CEO first and you say, tell me what happened, and they give you a PR response, and then you go poke holes in that PR response by talking to employees, you may not have that chance, that leverage, when you go back to the person in power that, you know, because they may not be interested in answering your questions then. Where if you save the CEO or people in power for last, you have those pressure points where it's like, listen, I know about this. If you don't want to talk about it, fine. But I'm going to report this, right? And that's not malicious. That's just journalism.
Yeah.
That's saying, I know A. If you want to tell me your side of A, that's fine. If you don't, I'll say you said no comment, but I'm going to write about A, right? And that's I think that's good job reporting. I wanted to talk about that because I guess the statement made me a little defensive because it just came across like this games journalist at Kotaku.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, really? Like,
but you know, and it also depends on, I mean, I guess I'm trying to not unbiased, but because I don't have the information, I'm just kind of just trying to say things. But what's his name? What's the journalist's name?
Ethan Gotch.
Ethan Gotch. You know, whatever he's writing about may have absolutely nothing to do with the CEO also. Exactly why he didn't go to.
Weird, but yeah. It could be a possibility.
You know, she already mentioned that she stepped down in the winter because of medical reasons. So who took over? And at that point in time, was that person responsible for everything that happened up until the end?
Which made her less of a priority to talk with. Right. So that's exactly. When you push her down the interview list or whatever. Yeah, there's a bunch of reasons why. But I don't know. To me, this just happened with you guys. I don't know if you guys know who Caitlin Clark is, women's college basketball. Caitlin Clark, her last season was this year. She played for Iowa. Anyway, so women's college basketball has had a resurgence of interest and popularity this year. There's a coach for LSU, Kim Mikulski, who is infamous for being an asshole. And the Washington Post was writing a Washington Post reporter was writing a profile about her. Mm-hmm. And like a week before the profile comes out, Kim Mikulski has a press conference and she says, "This Washington Post reporter is writing a hit piece about me. This is why people in America don't trust the media anymore, because it's just about clicks." Week later, the guy puts the story out. It's this incredibly long, complex story about Kim Mikulski and her career, and she talks with other players, and it's this really long, complex, and nuanced profile, right? But how is it framed? It's a hit job. It's clickbait, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, and this is the same thing. It's like, what do you do when you're going to be held to account? It's clickbait. It's a games journalist. And it's like, okay.
Fake news.
I'm sure when the story comes out, it'll just be, yeah, there was crunch. It was horrible. People cried everywhere else in the games industry, unfortunately. And that's the end of it. I don't know. That just frustrates me. It's like, okay, sorry. Journalism rant over.
No, I get it.
Is there anything else? Go ahead, Connor. I'm sorry.
So with their two responses, if it is just information about like financial, they're making it. It's much ado about nothing then, because the company is closing, so obviously the financials weren't good.
This is the problem, is we just don't know, because it could be that financial stuff got leaked, period, and because publishers are, you know, spineless, that spooked them and they ran away, because whether or not it's good or bad, it's just that the material got leaked at all.
Yeah.
So that could be what happened. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Sorry, was that
But their reactions with the nothing that's out right now about the story.
Yes.
it really makes it seem like there's more going on that they don't want people to know about.
It does.
Right.
It's called the Streisand effect.
Yeah, the Streisand effect.
Yes. You're like, don't look at this thing. And you make people think it's Leslie Nielsen in front of the fireworks factory. Nothing to see. Right? And it's just like, okay, if you do that, even if there is nothing to see there,
now everyone's going to be looking, poking and prodding.
Yes, exactly. And of course, a bunch of people lost their jobs. For in this industry that makes a quintillion billion dollars, more people are out of a job because of a bunch of stupid fucking reasons. So it's like, okay, whatever. Are we ready to move on?
Yeah. The Sabre CEO, Matthew Karch, has said some interesting stuff in a wide-ranging interview with GameIndustry.biz's James Batchelor. Sabre was part of Embracer before it was sold back to Beacon Interactive, which is possibly an investment company co-founded by Karch.
Yeah, I wasn't sure what precisely it was. It was a company co-founded by Karch.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if it's technically an investment company or what. It's private, but they are the company that now owns Sabre. So, yeah, anyway.
And on $70 price points, Karch said, quote, "We don't have to sell a game for $70. I'd prefer not to. I think that's expensive. I don't like that. Part of the reason why Helldivers 2 has had the success that it's had is because it comes in at a much lower price point and it's accessible. 5 years ago, all you heard about was the next Assassin's Creed or the next Call of Duty, Far Cry, Battlefield, or whatever else it was. The whole industry waited with bated breath for those games to come out. Those were the juggernauts. But now you're seeing stuff like Palworld, Helldivers 2, and Valheim come out and killing it. People are realizing that there's an opportunity to make great entertainment at a price that isn't going to kill somebody's bank account," end quote. He also said one reason AAA games are so expensive is that companies insist on making games in the most expensive territories. When asked about Space Marine 2, which is $70, Karch said, quote, "I mean, Focus, now Pull Up Entertainment, is the publisher and we're the developer, but this is Saber's game, and I would love to sell that, at least the digital edition, for less than $70, because we can, and I think we should. If you do games that look, feel, and play as good as this, it shouldn't matter how much money you spent on the game. What should matter is how many man months were put into that game. What were the resources put into that game, right?" End quote.
So there's a lot of stuff there. I love that he's like, "I want to sell it at less than 70. We should sell it at less than 70. But it's going to cost $70.
Yeah.
It's like, all right.
He also, yeah.
I mean, if you just want to say, because I think it's worth $70, and it's like, okay, fine. That's sure. A hill you want. That's the stance you want to make.
Yeah.
Fine. I respect taking that stance. Yeah. But this, I hate $70. $70 should go to hell. Guillotine, take $70 straight to the guillotine. But we're going to sell it for $70. Yeah. It's like, what are you doing, Matt? What the hell's going on?
Yeah, there? There's a lot of implications with the quote, too, or with the entire quote, because it's if he is so flippantly being like, we could sell any game we want for less than 70. Like, of course we could. Yeah. And it's Saber Interactive. What about Sony? What about Xbox? What are like how many of the way bigger
that's
publishers can
think.
Probably? Yeah, that's what I think, at least.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's nice that he's a bit candid about like, oh yeah, we could definitely sell it for less than 70, and that he wants to. But it kind of sounds like there's two different Pull Up Entertainment and then Saber. I guess the decision to make it 70 was like beforehand.
Yeah, it may
from the part
of their publishing.
Yeah, their hands are tied or something.
Yeah, and Saber Interactive has sort of in the past, I don't know, 5 years or so, has sort of carved out its own nice, almost like. Devolver Digital,
right,
carved out its own little like nice niche of action games and stuff like that. Insurgency Sandstorm is a game that they publish, although that studio had layoffs in December. Did they do the Sinking City? I don't remember.
I think they did.
Then there was World War Z, which was actually a really solid like co-op zombie shooter,
and it's still going strong apparently.
Yeah, there's a sequel came out, and I think the sequel got solid reviews as well. I haven't played it though. But so yeah, they've done it, and then Space Marine 2 looks awesome. I don't know if you've seen some of the gameplay footage.
Not yet. I hope it's better than the first game.
Space Marine 2 looks awesome.
Yeah.
Hold on a second. The first one was like peak 40K video game because it hit all the stupid tropey things that are in 40K.
Oh yeah, sure. No, like I was just pressing the same buttons over and over. That was for me. But it was cool. It was cool tearing up those orcs.
So yeah, they've carved out a nice little niche for themselves, and their games have never been like premium priced, right? I think World War Z was $40 when it launched. I don't think Sinking City was ever like a full price, $59.99. I don't think so.
That game also went through a lot of legality issues.
Yeah, I don't know if it was Sinking City. I thought Focus did
Call of Cthulhu?
They did some kind of Cthulhu game.
Okay.
I thought. Maybe not. I know Insurgency
Lovecraftian.
I know Insurgency Sandstorm has never been $59.99. I think it's either $29.99.
Never
or
been a
30.
Popular game either. Boom.
Hey!
I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
No,
it's very popular. No, it's very
really
popular.
Solid,
yes.
Yeah, it's a really solid. Like, it's counter because it's because Insurgency was a Counter Strike mod, if I remember correctly. So it has sort of the pacing of Counter Strike, but the one shot and you're dead kind of realism about it. Insurgency is actually really. I played some of it this past weekend, but. So it would make sense that they don't have to sell their games for $70 because they seem to limit the scope of their projects, and their projects have never been like gigantic 100-hour, you know, expeditions. They've been like World War Z had like, I think, 4 different chapters or something like that. You could complete it with a friend, 15, 20 hours, solid, couple weekends.
Yeah.
You're in and you're out. Quick adventure, Morty, let's go. Kind of like not a big deal. And I wish we would see more of that kind of stuff from the games industry. And it seems like Karch in this interview indicated that that's a possibility. The territories thing made me side eye a bit because I was like, are you saying that to fix our industry, we just need to outsource everything? the easy fix is just don't develop games in the United States. It's like, is that, I don't know. Bachelor didn't seem to ask a follow-up question on that or anything, but I thought that can't be like, obviously,
I think there are bigger reasons on the poll than there's territories thing.
Yes. Yeah. It makes sense that, like, because San Francisco, if you cough in San Francisco, like, you have to pay like an $8,000 property tax for that. It's ridiculous. So I get that all those studios in San Francisco and then Silicon Valley and stuff like that probably put a strain on financials, on company financials, to mention you have housing prices, so you have to pay employees so much. Not that employees shouldn't be paid, they should. But I do think there are some like financial realities there, right?
Yeah.
And to me, it seems like, okay, well, why don't we figure out how to develop games outside of the most expensive places in the US, not how do we develop games outside the U.S. entirely.
Yeah.
and I've always wondered, like, how I don't know how other countries, if there's like nationalized healthcare, how does that change a business, right? If you don't have to provide health insurance as a, like, an employer, let's say, like, Larian is in Belgium, I think is it Belgium? I'm gonna guess Belgium. I think Larian Studios HQ is in Belgium. I'm going to assume, because Belgium's in Europe, they have national healthcare. I'm just going to assume. I have no idea. So I would assume that that's like a cost that's easier on Larian because they don't have to worry about that if you have nationalized healthcare. Or Ubisoft in France. France has national healthcare, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. So it's like, and also Montreal. Montreal is a big Ubisoft.
Yeah. So I don't know about Canada. Studio. Yeah, they do.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah, so... so maybe that's part of the economic
literally thing. Everywhere else except here.
Yeah, I was gonna say, just sit me down, Tyler. You need to learn something real quick. The other thing that I thought was interesting, I don't know, again, it's like POW World, Helldivers 2, and Valheim are all successful for different reasons.
Yes.
POW World had Pokemon. That's why, I mean, I don't
want to... It was a novel idea, yes.
I don't want to be too reductionist, but come on.
Yeah, Pokemon and guns.
If the game, instead of Pokemon, it was dinosaurs, it would still be popular. It would not have gone viral, though. It went viral, I think, because of the Pokemon. Valheim is early access, so it's like a completely different animal. Is POW World an early access?
Yes, it is.
Okay. So POW World also has that, but Valheim is early access, and then Helldivers 2... you have Sony as a publisher.
Yeah.
So there's like different contexts there that I think it's like, again, trying to nail down why certain games are successful is both difficult and easy. Uh-huh. It's difficult if you're somebody who doesn't play video games and you're just an investor because you think every game has to be Fortnite and you don't understand why every game isn't Fortnite.
Mm-hmm.
But I think for us, it's like, we can see different reasons why games are successful. Not that success is easy. And we get frustrated on why don't companies focus on that variety of things you can do more often. So I think it's interesting that he points out all these different ways that you can be successful with games and how big budget games are getting more difficult and unsustainable, while at the same time saying, but we're going to sell Space Marine for $70 anyway. It's like, okay, well, you know, whatever. And we've had, you and I, Richard, we've almost gone to blows over the $70 discussion. Not really, but.
No, not yet. Not really. I mean, I don't like games that are $70.
No.
But it doesn't mean I don't think that there's so many things that they can do to lower that cost. I still sit here and I actually had to I once again talked to my coworker today because he was asking about Oh, he was, because we were talking about the place, somebody brought in a PlayStation Portal, and we were talking about that, and he was like, wow, yeah, it's astounding that Helldivers 2, like, runs on the Steam Deck. And I had to sit there and tell him, I'm like, well, actually, Helldivers 2 is, like, on a fucking 3DS engine. Like, you're an engine that was used for 2016. That was,
I didn't know that.
I did a tidbit on it.
Remember? You did?
Yeah, it was a couple of weeks back.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, it's not a 3DS engine, but it's the same engine as the original Helldivers.
Okay.
But the support for that engine stopped in 2018.
I remember that.
And that engine began to be used in 3DS, like, modding the community for freeware. But anyways,
I apologize.
But we have lots of different games that are very popular for lots of different reasons, and we have varying degrees of successes for each one. And we talked about Power World, of course, Helldivers. What was that on? But now we have two games recently within the last half year or year that have gotten really popular for also different reasons. Lethal Company. And now a Content Warning.
Content Warning, yeah.
Yeah, which Content Warning apparently was free, and there was like 6 million copies. For a while. And now it's paid for, and it sold another million.
Yeah.
So, and of course, you know, a Lethal Company is its own beast, but we talked about Devolver Digital. There was a game that was just released by Devolver Digital, and I forgot what it was called, but I saw somebody tweet about it, and they framed it, and they were like, I didn't even know this game came out. It's really good. It just sucks that this game has failed, like dead on arrival or whatnot. Mm-hmm. Why didn't Devolver do more for it? But Devolver found that thread and they came in. They're like, actually, we're pretty proud of what it's doing so far. So shut your mouth. So it's kind of like I think it's more of a like return on investment expectation of what you get from this game. Yeah. But unfortunately, what they want to do is focus on the shiny.
Yeah.
Everything, how good does this game look?
Has to be
how good does it, blah, blah. When realistically, I think that we need more of somebody who knows when to say stop.
Sure.
You know, every independent game is made because somebody has a really cool idea. But they know when to stop within their means. We don't need to. We always come back to this example. We don't need, you know, extremely realistic horses in Red Dead Redemption 2. We don't need Aloy's face, you know, facial hair. We don't need these things that a large majority of players completely overlook. And if you point it out to them, they'd probably go, "Oh, I didn't even realize," you know. I don't even know where I was going with this.
No.
I was just talking about that. Well, because we got on the $70 discussion. Yeah. But yeah, it's just one of those things that, like, is if I could sit here and be like, yeah, games are no longer $70, like, I could, but I know that, unfortunately, I can't do anything about it. So it's like, well, that's $70 now.
Yeah. And I'll always concede that I don't know, how expensive should games be? I don't know. Are there games out there that probably should be charging more but aren't? Yes, probably. But the $70 discussion is one of those things that I just think you can't just say inflation.
No, you can't.
And leave the door. But because like Madden, don't tell me for a second that you need 70 ducks.
No, absolutely 70, not.
70 ducks. You need 70 goddamn ducks to make a return on Madden. You need 70 bucks to make a return on Madden. That's bullshit.
Every
sports game.
You buy one Madden every year, $30. For the you know, roster changes and whatever. But you know, you also have the risk of creating a new issue with what you do, because physical game $70. Okay, fine. That digital version better be $50 or something. But
which was Alan Wake 2's, which was Remedy's excuse.
Right. But you run the risk of accelerating physical copies getting out the door, get out of here. You know, you run the risk of physicals being gone. And then so you have to kind of like play with that, like cause and effect type situation.
I wonder if the industry really cares about that. I don't know.
They do right now only because retail cares about it.
Because you're in a different situation because you're collecting. You're not the contemporary art dealer. Your wines aren't 2024 wines. Mm-hmm. You're like, this is a 1965 je ne sais quoi. That was the only French thing I could think of.
I have a... No, yeah, you're right. And I pull that on people a lot of times because I had a guy come in. I had like a bunch of Atari Lynx games. Have you ever heard of the Atari Lynx?
Yes.
Okay. Atari Lynx handheld games. So yeah. And there's like eight of them. He said, oh, if I buy all eight, can you give me a deal? And immediately I was like, hey, if they kept making these, sure, man. But these don't exist anymore. Like, they're like, if I had 20 of them, sure, I'd give you a deal. But no, that's all that's left. Like,
so if we ever make a TV show about Fallout games, it's gonna be Glenn Howerton as psychopath Dennis. When people ask it, it's like that episode where Mac and Dennis live in the suburbs. Yeah, and he's like, hot one, huh? It's a hot one in here. Like, he just turns out his neighbor and starts to freak out. Newsflash, asshole! I've been hearing it the whole time. What was I going to talk? Oh yeah, because retailers, right? Retailers? I don't know. Do game companies really care that much about like what Walmart thinks? I don't know.
I mean, not as much anymore. That's going out. That's slowly fading away, as we see from Best Buy no longer taking physical stuff.
Yeah.
I think Walmart's doing it too, because today, all day, people at Walmart's have been sending photos into Wario 64. All these Switch games that have just come out, bucks.
Damn.
Why? You know, YMMV, your mileage may vary, but just because they're clearancing them, get them out of here. And there's no games to replace those that are out right now. Yeah, so where are they going? What are they doing? They're just clearing them out. So. You know, 90s.
And that's interesting with Switch, because Switch is usually the best stocked console because it has so many of those mid tier cheaper games. Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I don't. I don't know what will happen. I'm very bad at playing the guessing game on what's gonna be in the future. But I always have hoped that one of two things would happen. The sillier one is that places like Blockbuster are gonna come back, because people want to have that physical thing. People want it. And the other thing is having a store that opens up that will. Walmart doesn't want those. Best Buy doesn't want those. I'll take those. And, you know, Nintendo, I don't know if they don't release their download NPC, NPD, or Circana numbers because they want to focus on physical only. But Nintendo is very much a tactile company. Yeah. Like, they want you to have the thing to be with and whatnot. So not as much anymore, but I think that that these game companies now have the pompous thought of they'll buy whatever we put out, because unfortunately it happens. Get NBA every year, Madden every year,
because you just got a huge casual audience. And those people aren't dumb. It's just that's what they do. You can't blame people for. I don't know. You can't blame people for the decline of an industry that knows it pointed the nose of the airplane down at the ground and says, well, this is what the passengers want us to do. It's like, well, no, Strauss-Zelnick, that's not what's going on. I had a separate thought, but it was is in the back of my head. It was about physical. So I wonder if we're not even talking about Matthew Karch anymore, which is totally fine.
Who cares?
Yeah, who gives a shit?
Fuck him.
Okay, no, I don't want to go that far. I don't want to go that
far. Burning our bridges before we built it.
Yeah. He's a friend of the show who'll be on the show next week. He's going to come to me.
No friend of mine.
No, I wonder if new physical game sales don't become almost like a boutique thing eventually. Where a store like yours maybe has a corner somewhere and you get you get I don't know, a game comes out, a big game.
Yeah.
Horizon 3, Ghost 2, and you get 10 copies.
Yeah, yeah.
Something tiny
No, that probably will. Probably will fall onto the mom and pops for a large amount of time before the next generation, not Gen Alpha, but after that is having the thing is pretty cool. And they come in, because.
But then again, your retailers are also selling consoles. Mm-hmm. So it's like. Yeah, I don't know. That's tough.
It is tough.
I know. Yeah. I know that in the UK, I don't think Tesco sells games anymore.
Yeah, I think Tesco stopped, and then Game is closed.
Which is the UK's version of GameStop. Right? Yeah. So So I don't know.
And GameStop, we keep hearing about, you know, all the stuff it's they're
been,
doing.
GameStop's been on fire for like,
but yeah,
three straight years now.
But they since the late 2000s, they've been chasing trends. That's all they've been doing. You know, I remember working there when we started doing phones, and it was like, what the fuck? Or not phone. We started doing iPods and iPads and stuff. Nice. And then we went to phones. Anyways.
Okay. Do you have tidbits?
I got tidbits. Yeah, I got a lot of tidbits.
Let me play the tidbit sounder.
What if I told you, in this world, there are bits, and there are tids, and Richard is the only man who can put them together into tidbits?
By the way...
There are two wars!
By the way... You may be going. Richard might be going big time, because Patricia Hernandez reached out on Twitter. Miss Hernandez,
yeah.
Did you ever reach out?
Yeah, I sent a message, but
okay, because I expect
they probably got a ton. So
yeah, because I expect you to keep up on that.
Yeah,
because you're gonna go big time, and you're gonna
big time.
You're gonna be like, yeah, I've got information.
Yeah.
This one time, a customer came in, and he's like, I've got Dante's Inferno for $3.99.
You're
like,
get the fuck out of here.
All right, sorry, tidbits.
Okay, you're gonna like this one. I can't remember if I don't remember reporting on this one, but I've been excited to share this one with you.
I'm excited.
All right, so are you familiar with the Playdate console?
Maybe.
Okay, so the Playdate console was released, I think, about 2 years ago now, and it's a little yellow handheld.
Yes, with a crank on it.
Yeah, it has a crank on it.
I know where this is
going. Some very unique games. All right, so you've probably seen it then. So a user on Twitter by the name of Alex Johansson has created a game on the Playdate console where he has leaned it. He's created a device to, like, lean it down and use the lever as a Morse code device. And what you do is you play a game that's very similar to Missile Command where you have battleships coming toward your position and you have to Morse code in with the lever where they are to try to take them out before they get to your, like, to breach your, like, your line, your front line.
Uh-huh.
So I just thought that was very cool, and I love the way that it looks. Cool. Yeah. So I'll send that to you guys or put it in the...
Yeah. Did you guys see the thing about the pallet? There's, like, a truck of Playdates was...
Oh, yeah.
Stolen or something.
Yeah, yeah. And just disappeared.
Disappeared, and there was all kinds. They had a big GDC talk about it. It's like a big mystery. They don't. It was stolen, but there's all kinds of.
They're going to pop up somewhere.
I'm sure they will. Yeah, and that thing, it's a pretty penny, too. It's like $300.
$250, right? $300, yeah.
But it looks cool.
Been some really neat neat stuff. I put the link at the top of our stuff for you. Anyways, excuse me, Gio Corsi, the former head of I don't have the whole position here. Whoops. Anyways, he was at Iron Galaxy Studios, and he was the chief product officer of Illphonic and the head of global second party games at Sony. Has now joined Nintendo of America as part of its AAA third-party games portfolio management team. He said, quote, "This week I began my new gig filled with fun and adventure. I've joined the Nintendo of America AAA third-party portfolio management crew to help great teams bring their amazing games to this legendary platform. On a personal note, Papa Mario is very proud. Here we go." So yeah, he's responsible for bringing the Yakuza series to the West.
Oh, okay.
At least as hard as it did during the PS3 era. He was responsible for a lot of really great moves over at Sony. So hopefully there'll be even more good moves with Nintendo.
I wanted to correct myself real quick. The Playday starts at $199.
Oh, does it? Okay.
Nowhere near as expensive as I thought it was, which is cool.
Right. I don't want to say downside. The catch for that console is there has to be a lot of people making games for that thing.
It's kind of a novelty.
And it's very, very niche, very novel. But those games are very unique.
Yeah.
Have you guys seen Gabe Newell recently?
No.
Lost a lot of weight?
He lost a ton of weight. Yes. Gabe Newell's lost a lot of weight. The a photo of Gabe Newell has appeared on the Starfish Neuroscience website, where he is a supporter of the Endeavor for Neural Interfaces and the like. So when you go to the website, you can go to our team and find his photo. Looking great. Looking really good.
Good for him.
Yeah, good for
him. Give developers more money.
Yeah, definitely. These two things happened while I was on vacation. Anyways. They're very disappointing. They're very cool, very disappointing. They're collector news, big collecting news. Both stories are from Chris Kohler, who's formerly of Kotaku and Wired.com. He is currently the editorial director at Digital Eclipse. He's also responsible for Atari 50, the Jeff Minter, LlamaSoft story.
He worked on
Karateka. Yeah. And Turtles.
The Karateka remake. No, yeah. I don't think he worked on the original one.
No, I didn't work on that. It was all Jordan Mechner, baby. Anyways, a very lucky group of resellers, fuckers, came upon a gold mine at an estate sale. They had posted a couple of sealed games, being some very rare TurboGrafx games, which ended up selling very quickly for very low prices, at least comparatively, because they didn't know what they had. They just posted them up for buy-it-now prices. And you don't do that because they can go for a lot more. A couple of them sold, and then they very quickly did not post anything else. Eventually, on different profiles, more games ended up on the pages for bids, where eventually a sealed copy of the original Castlevania ended up taking the title of the highest-selling video game for an eBay bid, ending at over $90,000. Right. Wow. Behind that was a sealed Kid Icarus for the Nintendo for over $80,000, and several other games fetching fairly high prices.
Do you think Kotaku
ended up speaking to one of them, and he's just like, "Yeah, I don't care about any of this shit. If I found it, put it online." So it's like, "All right, man." So
whatever.
Don't even care. Just second. I understand that's what I do as well. But I care about this shit.
I'm an appraiser. I think there's a difference.
I'm an appraiser.
There's a difference between, here's the thing. We are not the biggest fans of capitalism on this show. Okay?
Yeah.
But it's what we live in, and I think you fill a difficult position in the ecosystem that I think is reasonable. You have a business. If you wanted to give everybody all the stuff in your store for free,
yeah,
and it would be perfect and everybody could play it every day, mm-hmm. you would, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, yeah. If I had all the cartridges, yeah, but I can't.
You can't do that. So your position is different than the mercenaries who just sell this stuff off
mm-hmm.
and don't give a shit about any of it.
Mm-hmm.
So don't you degrade yourself like that ever again.
Thank you. I'm an appraiser. That's what I call myself. I'm an appraiser. So that was the first story. The second one is as arguably more terrible because it's Goodwill and everyone hates Goodwill. Group of games popped up for bid on the Goodwill website, including a complete in box copy of the very rare Little Samson for the original Nintendo. A cartridge only of that game can fetch over $2,000 depending on its condition. So complete in box would go for a lot more. But, Goodwill just gets this stuff for free.
Because people
are just like, you're a Goodwill, I'm giving it to people. And it's like, no, you're not. You're kind of giving it to a for-profit organization. Yeah. No, I will not tip you. No, I will not round up.
Everything is a scam, ladies and gentlemen. Everything is a scam. Okay, is that all the tidbits?
That's all the tidbits.
We don't have Circana today.
We probably do.
Mario Kart 8 sold a trillion copies. Everybody's playing Fortnite. The Switch isn't selling as well, but still outsold all consoles.
The people of I don't know what to call the denizens of Twitter.
Psychopaths.
Sure. These guys are attacking poor Matt Piscatella now.
For what?
Like, he'll just come out and be like, hey guys, this game isn't selling that well, and everyone will be like, fuck you, Matt. He'll be like, I'm just telling you what it is. Because I know he was giving some information, and then they're like, he had a tweet that was just like, I'm just telling you what it is, guys. Like, lay off me.
Sorry.
Psychopaths.
Just the way you said that is such an accurate portrayal of life on Twitter. It's just like, no matter what you say, it's just like, the sky is blue. Oh, yeah? Why don't you go to fucking hell? Like, I don't know what the big deal is here. Don't go on Twitter.
Oh, wait. No, hold on. Oh, Matt said, your favorite platforms, games, and business models will thrive and live forever. And then he says to everyone who thinks I'm biased for or against whatever, please remember my official position. oh my God.
I remember one of my all-time favorite college football tweets was, I forget the writer's name, but it was when the AP poll comes out at the beginning of the year, right?
Yeah.
and he just posted the AP poll is wrong. They cheat, unlike my team, which plays the game the right way, in all capitals. Like, he didn't even mention a team. He was just repeating all the bullshit that, like, it's just Twitter is just the worst place.
Terrible. It was awful.
It's just a terrible place. And Matty Ice will be on the show next week. Friend of the show. Friend of the show. Okay. Are we all good?
We're good.
Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at The Gaming Discourse. Go to our YouTube channel, YouTube.com/Gaming Discourse. Patreon.com/TheGamingDiscourse. We'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.